We began a new series of studies on the subject of suffering and patience, much needed topic, even for we very rich Americans. Okay, go ahead. So last week we were just setting up this study by looking at the subject of suffering itself. What is suffering? And the fact that suffering is a big part of our lives. As we talked about last week, we as Americans, especially in our very rich and prosperous society, we tend to view suffering as some kind of a horrible aberration. I mean, that's not what life is supposed to be. And we use this slide to highlight what the real problem is that oftentimes we have our priorities in life mixed up. We think that the primary objective in life is to find happiness, to be happy. And of course, when suffering hits, not if, but when suffering hits, what does that do to our primary objective? Well, it just torpedoes it. You know, my life's not worth living. If I can't be happy in this condition that God has put me in now with all the suffering, the terrible things happening to me. But if our primary objective in life is to become a better person, then that changes the dynamic entirely. You know, the whole question of, okay, then how do I live my life? How do I deal with suffering that comes my way? Is there a way that the suffering that I encounter in this life can in fact make me a better person? Can I leverage that bad thing to accomplish a greater purpose? And in that context, with that frame of reference then, suffering takes on an entirely different meaning in our life. And this, I think, is really the fundamental question that we need to wrestle with as we're dealing with suffering in our life. We look at this passage here in James chapter 5, which is going to be sort of the foundation of this whole series of lessons, where James talks about the need for patience in our lives. And he goes through a little quick catalog of some of the Old Testament characters who displayed a great deal of patience and perseverance and endurance in their lives as they were wrestling with the fact of patience. And we noted how many times James uses the word patient or some synonym for patience in this text. And of course, James's plea is be patient. Recognize that this life is not perfect. God never intended it to be perfect. And what we have to do is adjust our frame of mind to be willing to accept suffering. Not that we have to like it, but that we can use it to accomplish something greater as we learn how to persevere. And so tonight, we're going to be looking at the subject of God and suffering. This is the only part of this series that I'm going to spend any time talking about the arguments that people traditionally use to attack the idea of God on the basis of the existence of evil and suffering. And no doubt you've probably heard this argument before. If there is a truly good and all-powerful God, why does he allow suffering in this life? Why are we surrounded by so much evil in this world? If he was truly good and powerful, he'd do something about it. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So before we plunge into tonight's lesson, Ben is visiting with us, and if I could, I'd ask you to lead us in an opening prayer, please. So we're going to start this study this evening by going back in history to a Greek philosopher named Epicurus, who is the one who first developed an articulate argument against the existence of God, as he was traditionally understood. And his argument went this way: if God is willing to prevent evil, but not able to prevent it, then he's not an all-powerful God. Does that make sense? He also posited that if God is able to prevent evil, but even though he's able, he chooses not to prevent evil, then he's not good. And to a point, that sort of makes sense. Then he followed, if he is both willing to prevent evil and able to prevent it, then why does evil exist at all? God would have taken care of it, right? And then finally, the fourth possibility, if he is neither willing nor able, then why call him God? I mean, that's, you know, he's no better than you or me. We're not willing necessarily in some cases, and we're certainly not able to eliminate all suffering. So this is a typical argument from ancient times against the existence of God. And so what modern philosophers have done is kind of trim that down into something that's in more of a logical form based on a first premise, that premise being it is logically impossible for God and evil to both exist. The second premise in this argument is suffering exists. We all agree to that. And the conclusion is, therefore, there is no God. Now, this, in its simplest form, is the argument against God on the basis of evil and suffering. And if you ever talk to an atheist, somebody who's skeptical about the existence of God, quite often some version of this argument will be trotted out. How can you believe in God when there is so much evil and suffering in the world? If he truly was the God that you claim he is, then he would do something about that. So how do you answer that question? What I'd like for us to do now for the next few minutes is re-examine the first premise. The second premise, suffering exists, that's a given. I mean, nobody except for Buddhists and maybe Christian scientists, nobody is going to argue that point. Suffering certainly exists. But let's take a closer look at the first premise. It is logically impossible for God and evil to both exist. Now, in order for that statement to be true, you have to sneak in two very important assumptions. The first assumption you have to make is that if God is all-powerful, he can create any world he wants. And actually, I would not disagree with that. If God is all-powerful, he can create any world he wants. But take that assumption to its next step. If he can truly make any world that he wants, what if he wants to create a world populated by creatures with free will? What is free will?
Choice.
Choice, meaning that these creatures he creates, they can make choices of their own, independent of him. Now, he may have a desire as to what kind of choice they would make, but having made them free will moral agents, he's not going to interfere with their choices. He makes these creatures with the ability to make their own choices and decisions, and then he stands back and says, okay, now it's your game. You do what you want to do with the talents and abilities and the skills and the material that I've put in front of you. Now, I'm sorry, Frank. If we choose to do so,
yeah.
Right? Exactly. Yeah, that's the whole point. And of course, If he chooses to create a world populated by creatures with free will, then what risk is he running? That there will be evil, thanks to these free will creatures that he's put in this world that he created. So, while it's true that God is able, and in a sense is willing to deal with suffering, if he chooses, according to that first proposition, if he chooses to create a world comprised of creatures with free will, free moral agency, then there is built into this world the risk that suffering or evil is going to appear. The second assumption then that is built into this first premise, that it is logically impossible for God and evil to both exist, is that if God is all-loving, he prefers a world without suffering. So if he is the God that we claim him to be, then he would choose a world without suffering if he really loved us. That is an assumption. And the reason we say that is, number one, how could we know that that is true? That God would prefer a world without suffering? Right? Bear children with pain. Of course, that came after sin, right? That came after sin entered the picture. That was part of the curse on her, right? Which gets us back to the original question, why did God allow that, right? But also, let's consider that even in our own experience, don't we acknowledge that some suffering is necessary to accomplish a greater good? Have any of you ever had a medical procedure, an operation, a surgery, something that brought you a great deal of pain in the procedure itself? Yes or no? Of course, yeah, many of us have. Okay, the obvious question is, why did you subject yourself to that? Are you an idiot? Why did you do it? Because you saw a long-term benefit. There was some problem, there was some issue in your body that needed to be remedied, and the only way to fix the problem was to go through that bit of temporary pain and suffering. You went through some suffering in order to achieve a greater benefit somewhere down the road. And all of you who have been involved in any kind of athletic endeavor, what do you have to do in order to perform well in your particular sport or activity? No pain, no gain. There's a lot of training, right? A lot of hard work. You have to discipline yourself to do the work that's necessary to perform well in what you've chosen to do. The pain is necessary to achieve what you've set out to accomplish. And we could multiply examples of this. So all I'm trying to say is that in our own limited experience as human beings, we recognize that there is a legitimate place for pain, for suffering. And sometimes you just have to do that. As children, how many of us were disciplined by our parents? Was it fun? Was it pleasant? Probably not. Now, looking back on it, are you glad your parents disciplined you? I think so. Yeah. I mean, what would we be like if we didn't get that discipline? Look at our world today. That's right. Yeah, I mean, get to see a good example of what a lack of discipline will do. So the whole point is that when people argue in this first premise, it is logically impossible for God and evil to both exist, they're making a couple of very unfounded assumptions. And both of those assumptions are what need to be challenged. If God is all-powerful, He can create any world He wants. True, but if He chooses to create a world with free moral agents, then He's going to get suffering. And He chose to create that kind of a world. The second assumption, if God is all-loving, He prefers a world without suffering. That is just simply an assumption that we make from our very limited experience. And what experience we do have would argue that, in fact, there is a legitimate place for suffering. So that assumption falls flat. All right, and it's for this reason, we just have run through this very quickly, it's for this reason that many atheist philosophers today have pretty much given up the argument from evil in trying to argue against the existence of God. Here are a couple of quotes that I came across. J.L. Mackey, "We can concede that the problem of evil does not, after all, show that the central doctrines of theism are logically inconsistent with one another." And then William Rowe said, "Likewise, some philosophers have contended that the existence of evil is logically inconsistent with the existence of the theistic God. No one, I think, has succeeded in establishing such an extravagant claim." So here you have two skeptics, among others we could look at, who have basically thrown up their hands and said, you know, just logically speaking, this argument doesn't really hold any water. And they backed away from it, and they tried to attack the existence of God from other directions. Now, we could stop at this lesson right here and say, okay, we've answered the atheist's objections. Their claim that there cannot be a God because of the existence of evil and suffering in the world is bogus, and it does not support their claim. But I want us to keep pressing on this. We're going to back up now and take a different direction, because there's another angle here that puts the atheists on the defensive. It's not just us that has to answer the question of evil and suffering, but everybody has a problem. Yes, we have a problem in having to defend the existence of God in the presence of evil. Why would a good, all-powerful God allow evil and suffering? That's something we have to wrestle with, and it's not an easy one to do. But at the same time, the atheist has a problem, and we'll call it the problem of good. So just take this whole argument and flip it upside down and challenge the atheist to explain the existence of what he calls good. Now, usually the response on the part of the atheist is a puzzled look. Well, what do you mean, explain good? Good is a good thing. Everybody knows that. Right? We all want what is good, right? I mean, why do you need to defend that? But press the point. For example, why do humans cling to the notion of good and evil in judging behaviors? Now, we just touched on this briefly last week. This fella who shot up Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago. Have you heard anybody, in all the commentary that's been generated on that incident, have you heard anybody say, well, we just need to, you know, not be judgmental about this man. We just need to understand where he was coming from. Understand his plight in life. Have you ever heard anybody argue that? I haven't. Virtually everybody, regardless of where they stand on the God question, points to that and says, that was pure, unadulterated evil. That was wrong what that man did. And he should be judged for it. And I agree with that. But then to the atheist, I would ask the question, why? What makes what he did bad or the opposite of good? Why shouldn't he have the right to do that if that's what he chooses to do? The atheist, in the absence of God, will argue that all biology, all life, is just the result of random forces of evolutionary biology, and that evolutionary biology demands a survival of the fittest, right? You've heard that. We were subjected to that teaching in school. That evolution operates on the principle that the strong eat the weak. The strong outlives, out-survives the weak. The weak grow weaker and pass away, and the strong dominate. And that's just the story of history, right? Somebody have their lights on? I think we have a volunteer. Thanks, Mike. So in that context then, if in fact all of human life, all of human endeavor is just boils down to evolutionary biology, the strongest survive, strong eat the weak, then what is the basis of morality? In fact, most atheists, when you start talking about morality, they'll just shrug their shoulders and say, well, morality is just a human construct. It's just something that humans have come up with to allow themselves to get along with one another. Okay, I'll buy that, but I have to come back to the question, why? Why should I sacrifice myself, my welfare, my goods, my time to benefit you? Do lions and zebras operate on that principle? Yes or no? Well, of course not. So why should it be any different among human beings? And of course, the atheists will say, oh, don't be ridiculous. I'm not being ridiculous. I'm simply taking your evolutionary biology principle that explains all life to its logical conclusion. There's no difference between you and me and the lion and the zebra. One is strong, one is weak. The strong eat the weak. That's just evolution doing its thing. There is no God. There is no objective standard of morality that hangs above us and that regulates or seeks to regulate our behavior. So then, there is no inherent compelling reason why we should choose good over evil. And that's why I say that while the Christian struggles with the problem of evil, why is there evil and suffering in the world? The atheist has to struggle with the question, why is there good in the world? Why do we have people who choose to sacrifice of themselves in order to benefit others, and they get nothing in return? The article in the bulletin last Sunday, if you read that, I touched on this point, that while it is true that there was just stark evil on display in what happened in Las Vegas, what else did we see in that incident? Heroes, bravery, courage, self-sacrifice, people putting themselves in harm's way in order to protect and help those who had been hit or were in danger. And we have to ask why. What is it about human beings that there's this instinct to put yourself out for somebody else? The atheist cannot explain that. Now, they try. There have been a number of books written by atheists to try to appeal to some kind of a... And of course, they have to tie it back to evolution somehow. But it all breaks down. I mean, ultimately, there just really is no inherent reason why we have to be a moral people. Look at it this way. This is a simple way to express it. If, as according to atheistic philosophy, our origin is insignificant, meaningless, we came from nothing, and our destiny is insignificant, it is meaningless, we're going into oblivion, to nothing, then why not have the courage to admit our life right now is insignificant, it is meaningless, it has no value? There is no inherent advantage or goodness that would require us to sacrifice ourselves for others. And so that fact has led to what some have called secular schizophrenia. And Tim Keller came across this great quote that I think just stands out and captures the whole idea of what's going on here. This lady, Mari Ruti, is a professor at the University of Toronto, made this statement in one of her books. Although I believe that values are socially constructed rather than God-given, I do not believe that gender inequality is any more defensible than racial inequality, despite repeated efforts to pass it off as culture-specific custom rather than an instance of injustice. Now, I've broken down here what this lady is arguing. She first states that values are socially constructed. They are not from God. Now, if they're socially constructed, what does that mean? Culture, society. Each society, each culture just creates out of whole cloth whatever values it chooses to operate on. Are all societies going to come up with the same set of values? No. Did Nazi Germany have a different set of values than we have? In some respects, yes. Yeah, there are some gray areas there, obviously. I'm talking about the big items. Is it okay to gas 6 million Jews? Would we do that here in America? No, we just slaughter little unborn babies, right? Big difference, right? So she argues that values are socially constructed, they're not from God, and then she turns around and says, gender equality and racial inequality are indefensible. What does she mean by indefensible? Give me some synonyms for that. You can't justify. These things are wrong. They're bad. They're evil. And we need to, we cannot tolerate these things. We need to do away with them. Well, what is she arguing? That there are some things that are right and some things that are wrong. My question is, by what standard are her values more valid than others? I guarantee you, there are some places you can go in this world today where if you were to argue for gender equality or racial equality, they would look at you like you came from Mars. Because their societies, their cultures are based on a total inequality between the genders and between races. And to them, that's just the way the world works. That's their value system. They have no problem with it. But yet this lady comes along and says, no, that's not right. Well, what does she base it on? It's not God. She admits it's socially constructed, right? So that's why some have called this, there's a schizophrenia going on here, where some people are trying to play two different roles, two different parts at the same time. Look also at a statement that Keller made, and he has a whole chapter on this subject in this book that I was looking at, Making Sense of God. So he sums it up this way: how then can we tell if a human being is good or bad? Only if we know our purpose, what human life is for. If you don't know the answer to that, then you can never determine good and bad human behavior. If, as in the secular view, we have not been made for a purpose, then it is futile to even try to talk about moral good and evil. Look also at another statement that I came across from David Bentley Hart. He says, quote, "It is certainly not the case that one needs to believe in God in any explicit way in order to be good. But it certainly is the case that to seek the good is already to believe in God, whether one wishes to do so or not." Now, this is important. Am I arguing here, or any of these writers, are we arguing that if you're an atheist and you don't believe in God, then that automatically makes you a bad person? You're an evil person in everything you do in this life. Can there be such a thing as a good atheist? Trick question. Absolutely. Yeah. Atheists can be very moral, they can be very kind, very generous, very honest. But in order to do that, they're having to borrow from God. In fact, that's what this man argues here. To seek the good is already to believe in God, whether he wishes to do so or not. And then finally, this quote here comes from Frank Turek, a book that I highly recommend. If you've not read this book, you ought to get it and read it, called Stealing from God. He says, quote, "In one breath, atheists are claiming there is no good, evil, or justice. It's all an illusion. We just dance to the music of our DNA." And he's actually quoting an atheist there. "In the next breath, they are outraged at the great injustices and evil done by religious people in the name of God." Well, atheists can't have it both ways. Evil can't exist unless good exists. But good can't exist unless God exists. In other words, there can be no objective evil unless there is objective good, and there can be no objective good unless God exists. If evil is real, and we all know it is, then God exists. And really what he's doing, this comes out of this book, Stealing from God, this whole book pursues the line of thought that in order for atheists to have any semblance of rational thought with regard to morals or science or anything else, ethics, they have to steal from God to get it. Most of what passes as atheism today is based upon a long historical tradition of Christian thought and philosophy. And atheists, they're not willing to acknowledge that fact. And so it falls back on what these writers have called atheistic or skeptical schizophrenia. Very quickly, I want to go through a few examples of atheists who, following the line of reasoning that we're talking about here this evening, they actually reasoned their way out of atheism and into theism, belief in God, because they recognized what a logical dead end they were pursuing. For example, this first one is by an atheist, A.N. Wilson, and he grew up in, I think, the Church of England, and as he went off to college, like so many young men of his generation, he got off to college and surrounded by all this high-polluting talk in the universities, he gave up God, and he became a very prominent atheist, published some books, and did a great deal of work in trying to attack the idea of God. But later in life, he had an awakening. He turned around and recognized what a mistake he had made. And here's the way he described it in an article in the Daily Mail a few years ago. Quote, "Materialist atheism is not merely an arid creed, but totally irrational. Materialist atheism says we are just a collection of chemicals. It has no answer whatsoever to the question of how we should be capable of love or heroism or poetry if we are simply animated pieces of meat. But an even stronger argument is the way that Christian faith transforms individual lives, the lives of the men and women with whom you mingle on a daily basis, the man, woman, or child next to you in church tomorrow morning." Now, he doesn't use the word in this quote, but what's he arguing from? What's he appealing to as a justification for believing in God? Love, heroism, poetry, the change or the transformation of individual lives. Good, the presence of good. Why do we as human beings, we look at something that involves what we call good, and we instantly recognize it. We say, that's good. That's positive. We need more of that. And then other things, like what happened in Las Vegas, we instantly recognize, that's wrong. We should not, we cannot do that. How can you make that distinction? This man is arguing, this is what led him out of atheism. He had no basis as an atheist for making those kind of distinctions in his worldview. Let's look on in the next one. This one is probably more well known. If you've read any of C.S. Lewis's work, this is just the classic story. This is out of his little book, Mere Christianity, another one that you ought to pick up and read if you've not read it. Here's C.S. Lewis's story of how he left atheism and became a believer. Quote, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust." In other words, it's an argument based on the presence of evil, right? Suffering. Okay, now here's what happened to him. Quote, "But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, I was forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. Now, if you read that carefully and compare it to the earlier quote from that woman professor in the University of Toronto, they're saying basically the same thing. Only Lewis recognized the contradiction in his thinking, and that's what turned him back to God. This woman professor still can't see the contradiction in what she's saying or believing. One more that we'll look at here. Anthony Flew was, by all accounts, he was the champion atheist throughout the latter half of the 20th century. He was a British philosopher who debated believers left and right. He just was a devout atheist, and he was their champion. But late in life, he wrote a book called There Is a God. He changed his mind. And here's what he said. Certainly, the existence of evil and suffering must be faced. However, philosophically speaking, that is a separate issue from the question of God's existence. From the existence of nature, we arrive at the ground of its existence. In other words, he came to believe that there was a God based on the laws of nature that pure evolution could not explain. Nature may have its imperfections, but this says nothing as to whether it had an ultimate source. Thus, the existence of God does not depend on the existence of warranted or unwarranted evil. So here's, again, a man who came to the understanding that the presence of evil in this world does not negate the possibility of God. And he had to face the music, and he made the abrupt change, which just shocked many of his contemporaries. And then finally, this last chart, which kind of summarizes everything. If there is no God, then number one, suffering still exists. You haven't gotten rid of the suffering. You've got to find another way to deal with it. And if there is no God, we have no absolutely recourse for dealing with that suffering. In other words, you're on your own, buddy. There is no way to explain it. There is no way to work it into your worldview. And then number three, if there is no God, there exists no compelling moral reason for not visiting suffering on other people. Now, you may not act upon that, but deep down in your heart, you have to understand there's no reason why I should be good or not be evil. All right, next week, we're going to have a guest speaker. Steve Sanders, I think, is going to teach the class for me, and it's going to be a separate subject. And then the following week, we're going to talk about the benefits of suffering, which almost sounds like an oxymoron. But we'll go deep into the possibilities of what suffering can, in fact, bring into our lives if we will open our minds to see it for what it is.